Hey, you found the Mincing Rascals again. Thank you for that. Do share us with your friends. Do give us good reviews if you think we deserve them. And if you want to reach out to us, just write to me, John Williams, at WGNradio.com. The Rascals roll in about 60 seconds. We will talk about, in fact, we just found out about more lockdowns, not just for the state of Illinois, but for the city of Chicago. Auntie Lori is mad at us again. Then we'll talk about the Tony La Russa story. A lot of people are mad at him. And then finally, the president's refusal to leave the White House. Or is he changing his tune? Hey, how's your knee doing? Have you been to the Joint Relief Institute yet? The Joint Relief Institute's got two locations in Orland Park and Oak Brook. They use digital imaging. They see where the tissue in your knee's worn away, and then they put a joint lubricant into that exact spot. They Jiffy Lube your knee. It's a quick, pain-free, non-surgical procedure that not only will your insurance probably pay for, Medicare too, but they've got an insurance expert to make sure you get the maximum coverage. Now, we've got ice coming in the wintertime, and I know the sidewalks and roads are just going to be a little slipperier. And if you don't have confidence in your step, it's treacherous. So let's take care of that right now, while you still can, while before it gets too cold. Here's their phone number and website. The phone number is pretty easy to remember, as the website is too. It's jointreliefinstitute.com. JointReliefInstitute.com or call 708-888-0000 as in zero pain. Today is Thursday. It's November 12th, 2020, the worst year ever. Hi, I'm John Williams, and this is The Mincing Rascals, the podcast we record via Zoom. I'm at WGN Radio, and you can listen to me weekdays from 9 to noon.
I'm Austin Bird from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Lisa Donovan. I write the Spin Politics newsletter for the Chicago Tribune.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the increasingly amused columnist from the Chicago Tribune.
Okay, Eric, why are you increasingly amused?
Well, I was frightened and horrified by Trump's refusal to concede, and the longer this goes on, the more amused I am at this. We'll talk about that later. But I just say, it's become comedy at this point, I think. It's farce.
I've been on that emotional cycle, too. You know, first I was sad that Trump won, then I was glad that Biden won, then I got nervous that Trump was refusing to cede power and maybe they would pull some levers and make it happen, and now it doesn't look like it's going to happen. I come to you today alone, forlorn, and by myself, or as we put it in 2020, at Thanksgiving, because our city and state are re-locked down. There will be no indoor dining in restaurants, wink, wink, in Illinois. And in Chicago, there's a new 30-day lockdown. You are only to leave home for work, school, food, or medical reasons, and you're not to be in the company of more than 10 people. You thought you were frustrated before this. This city is struggling with either not enough transparency or people who just refuse to understand the science. But here we are now, double-digit percentage infection rates in the city, the county, and the collar counties. Are you all surprised by where we are right now?
I'm surprised right now. I was expecting maybe a repeat somewhere around December. I think I'm surprised that it's happening now. We all heard sort of like about winter. Winter's going to be bad. Winter's going to be bad. And we've had a fairly nice fall. And so I think I'm surprised that it's spiked now. Where we've all been outside a bit more and mild temperatures statewide. But I knew we were going to be here at some point.
Yeah, it feels like the combination of COVID fatigue and the colder, drier indoor air is really hitting us. It's a double whammy. And President-elect Biden warned us about a dark winter ahead, and I think we're going to see that.
I could add a nice silver lining.
Yeah.
So our cases are very, very bad if you just look at cases, right? So I think we're up 4x from the peak. If you look at deaths, we are still down 50% from the peak. And I know deaths are a very lagging indicator, but we've had the spike for a few weeks now. So you would expect those to catch up. And hospitalizations are rising. But what you're seeing is this, to me, is a very different kind of spike than what we saw in May.
Why?
Especially if you look at the ages of people who are, so IDPH breaks down age brackets of people who have it and who were really overrepresented in May were older folks and a lot of deaths in retirement homes. And you saw them overrepresented in cases as well. And what we're seeing in the last 3 months is an overrepresentation of younger people in the case count. And I think that it's not surprising that our deaths and hospitalizations aren't as bad as they were at the peak, if that is indeed the population that's that we're seeing this burn through right now.
So you don't expect the death numbers to jump the way they would if it was an older population, right?
Exactly. Like if that winds up being the case. So it's very interesting to see that, because the case fatality rate in Illinois is much lower now than it was in May. I think it's around a fourth or a fifth of what it was. And I think a lot of that has to do with the population of who's having cases or who's reporting cases.
But we don't know yet exactly what the long-term effects of COVID-19 right. are on some of these younger people. I mean, they talk about heart damage and even mental illness that hits people after they get and seemingly have recovered from the immediate effects of COVID-19. So, yeah, it's tough news. Obviously, if it's going to hit a younger population, the younger population just seem to be more resilient to it and can bounce back. The hospitalization rates, though, are at least the stuff that I'm reading says that the health officials are alarmed about.
That's exactly what Dr. Arwady, the Chicago Department of Public Health boss, just said during this news conference a short time ago, that she's more worried than any other time, since March even, because of that, because the numbers are growing and because we're seeing hospital beds fill up. And regionally, I don't know if you saw this report out of Northwest Wisconsin, but Mayo Clinic runs a bunch of hospitals up there. They said that all of their hospitals are 100%, every bed is full. They're absolutely at capacity. And it is something to worry about, because we know sort of these outbreaks are sort of, they are regional. You see these trends follow regional lines, 3 states, 4 states, 5 states.
I don't mean this as a pro or anti-governor thing, but I was always proud of Illinois that we weren't Indiana or Wisconsin. We mocked Wisconsin's numbers. And, we're double digits everywhere now. We're not that much different than them. And I want to think that we're smarter or better managed or something, that Illinois had it figured out, or at least Chicago did, and Wisconsin didn't. And here we go. It's embarrassing is what it is.
I'm not sure if there is room to be embarrassed about how our elected officials are reacting to this. It's still an unknown, this is still an unknown thing. It really did come on quite quickly. That's why we're calling it a spike and a surge. And I think they're stunned by it. I think that they thought, okay, well, this isn't going to happen. They're following the science. The CDC is saying that we're going to see this uptick in December. And now all of a sudden it's happening now.
Yeah. But remember, the price we were paying, Lisa, early on was, all right, we're going to shut down harder than the other states, but we'll have the last laugh. And nobody's laughing right now,
Seems very regional, and everywhere in the Midwest is really spiking right now. And I think one thing that I think Illinois has a lot to answer for and should be embarrassed by is the deaths in long-term care facilities and retirement homes. It was 55% of the deaths back in the spring were in those settings. And in the last 3 months, it's still around 40-50% are happening in those settings. And why, it feels like we're kind of devoting resources to the wrong, not to the wrong place, but we're not dedicating enough resources that are targeted to those settings to stop the deaths in those contexts, which are still very high.
Have you seen any good reporting on that, Austin, about why that would be, why Illinois would be doing poorly in that area? Are we not testing employees enough? Do we don't have screening procedures that are good enough?
I would be curious about what the best practices have been in other states, but I think it's pretty clear that there hasn't been enough learning since the spring to make that happen. I mean, it could be an NBA style bubble, right? Like we know that there are contexts that are possible in which spread is prevented, but it doesn't seem that those practices are being followed in Illinois nursing homes. And I believe there was change in leadership in the governor's administration on who was sort of in charge of that because of how poor those results were.
One of the early reports I saw, it, I was struck by it on 60 Minutes, was that the very nature of these nursing homes, you can only do so much. They are understaffed. Mm-hmm. They, that, you know, funding, government funding has been cut to some of these places and you just don't have enough people. So as much as you're having people sort of change garments, you know, the staff are changing garments, there are sometimes when there's an emergency and you don't have time.
Right. But that wouldn't explain any regional differences in that Austin's talking about. This is what you're talking about, Lisa, would be something you would see everywhere.
Right.
In these kind of care homes.
Yeah, so. Well, you saw it in Seattle. So yeah, I don't know. I haven't seen that we were doing worse than other places. So I don't know.
I'm getting skeptical of the whole idea of bubbles, of little family bubbles, because you know there's so many points of contact. We have a fairly small little family unit at our house. My son and his girlfriend, my wife and I, we don't have much contact. We're very careful. But you know, my son's girlfriend goes to law school. She's got to go into in-person classes, and she takes the train in and out a couple times a week. And my son has a job, and he's in contact with people. And so if this is as contagious as we think it is, I don't know if a bubble, unless you're seriously quarantining, a bubble is really an illusory concept, and the comfort you should get from it is pretty small, I would think.
You nervous, Eric, about one of those vectors bringing it into your house?
I'm totally nervous about it. I'm talking to you right now from Ann Arbor, Michigan. I'm here helping take care of my mom, who's been in the hospital the last week. And, you know, and the people in the hospital, they all wear masks. And we have care in the home for my mom, and they're all wearing masks. But still, you know, there's just lots of points of contact. They're exposed to all their social circle. We're exposed to all our social circle. Mm-hmm. And the masks they help, but they're not perfect by any means.
Yeah.
So now that I'm in Michigan, when I come back, I've got to quarantine for 14 days.
Oh, that's right. You just missed the deadline, didn't you?
Yeah, so I can't come to your party, John. Your super spreader party.
Yeah, no, Brenda and I were talking about that because last year we all got together for pizza and beer at Malnati's, and I think I'm going to put together a care package and leave it on your doorsteps, and we'll have to do it. We'll have to do it virtually.
What are we doing for Thanksgiving? What are you guys doing for Thanksgiving?
We're staying here. It's the two of us, and we're staying put.
You traveling, Austin?
I think it's going to be weather dependent. So myself and my fiance both have family in the suburbs, and basically it's like if you can stand to be outside, then Thanksgiving is a go, or in a sort of like a garage setting or a place with a lot of ventilation. But if it's everybody inside for, you know, a day, which is what you do on Thanksgiving, you sit around and watch TV together. And
yeah, really.
And I don't know if that's safe. I mean, I do know that isn't safe, and we probably won't be doing that.
It'll be the five of us, my wife, my two sons, and our daughter-in-law, and that's the pod that we've created, and we all seem to – it's a risk we're all willing to take. That's how we live. Three of us live in one condo, and two live in the other condo, and we do mix. However, infrequently, I'll see my son and daughter-in-law twice a month. But I know that when I come home, every now and then I'll find myself going up to embrace my wife or pat my son on his head, and they flinch, and it's getting worse. Right? They see me as more and more toxic. And why wouldn't
John,
they?
John, aren't you immune? You had it, didn't you, John? I mean, you already
Well, what you am I? It. Yeah, I've got the antibody, but what does that mean now? And I had it in March or April, so this
well, it
is...
means you can hug me, as far as I'm concerned.
You know, I don't know that I should. I mean, last I heard was 90 days of immunity, and that's to me. But could I give it to you? And whenever I ask experts, and it seems like that's all I do for a living... You kind of get these, well, we're not sure. That's a good question. And, wow. You know, they don't seem to know.
Were you asking Ringo Starr?
Why?
The guy's voice you were using.
Wait a minute. I missed a joke. What was that?
Were you asking Ringo Starr? That's what it sounded like was answering.
Oh, no kidding. Did I just drop into a little of that? How about that?
Drop into a little Ringo there, yeah?
It's got it. You have to feel like, you know. The Elephant Man or something.
Oh, totally.
That's very difficult.
And it's legit, too, right? Like, trust me, I don't want to get it again, and I don't want to give it to them, but I understand why they feel that way. Do you guys also think, though, that there's this, it's not just impatience that the city and state officials are having to grapple with on the part of the citizenry, it's a lack of understanding. Now, Austin, you may not entirely agree with this, but that the science is generally on their side, and they've got it right. But even if they do, they're not explaining it to us in terms that people are embracing, right? So it's a messaging issue as well.
I think part of it could be, I don't necessarily disagree with you on like what settled science, but part of that is that broad lockdowns seem to not affect really what we're looking at the end of the day, which is hospitalizations and deaths, at least on a state-by-state level. I don't think there's good evidence of that. Now, what I think could be difficult is that when we're talking about these new measures like no indoor dining and things of that nature, the costs are increasingly high because there isn't federal aid anymore. And Illinois had the worst jobs loss in the country back from September to October. And we're seeing some of the highest new unemployment claims in the country over the last 2 weeks. So I think there's a sense in which that those people are kind of going out of the frying pan and into the fire, and there's not a safety net for them. So I could understand why that makes it more difficult to impose some of these more strict measures, because the cost has become higher.
Them being restaurant owners or employees?
Yeah, workers, restaurants, lots of different industries. There's ripple effects.
What's the very latest intelligence on if this the new Pfizer vaccine is effective? What's the timetable on when podcast panelists can get their hands on it? I mean, I know essential workers get it first, which probably don't include radio hosts or columnists or think tank marketers. So who gets it, and when do we get it? When does this vaccine reach us?
Next summer, but I don't want to say correct.
We won't know if it's 100% good to go until 2 months, I believe, right? Because they're measuring sort of medium-term health effects. But yeah. If it's good to go then, yeah, I think Lisa is right, somewhere around the summertime.
They expect to make 1.2 billion doses available next year. 300 million have already been committed to the European Union. You know, I asked two doctors from Northwestern, including the chief medical officer at Northwestern, I asked him if he would take the vaccine when it became available, and he said no. If it were available to him today, he would not take it because he doesn't know what the side effects are or the other issues are. He said it's going to take 2 or 3 months before any of us get our hands on it anyway, and by then we'll know, so it'll be a moot point.
Well, I was going to correct myself. I don't know. I would like to see what happens with other people. Yes. Earliest we can get this vaccine to the public would be February, but it's more likely to be available to the general public in July or August.
Yeah. Well, then you guys were about right. I mean, I don't know who those people are in February. And isn't it weird that, okay, good, you're in the front of the line, and then a lot of people are happily moving to the back of the line. They don't want it. Lisa, yeah, I've got some right here. You want some? Yes or no?
No.
Eric?
No, I wouldn't, because I do. You would want to see it tested. We've had some experiences with vaccines that have some pretty nasty side effects. I am confident, however, because of the timing of this vaccine, the news about it, that it wasn't rushed out before the election. That it felt like Pfizer was working on their own timetable here. I was actually quite concerned that a vaccine would come available, say, at the end of October. And there would be this incredible doubt over, no matter how much integrity the scientists had, there would still be this incredible doubt that they were being pressured to okay an unsafe vaccine because Trump wanted to be reelected. I don't think that's the case. Now, there's no political advantage at this point for anybody to get a new vaccine out. So it does feel like there's more validity to the scientific claim. If it's going to be July, we are in for a really long, grueling winter. Certainly, and no. Spring will be difficult as well by that time.
Was intrigued by the story in the New York Times this week where they talked about these two Turkish scientists who came up with this at that BioNTech company. It's in Germany, and they're immigrants from Turkey, as husband and wife. And then they collaborated with Pfizer. They had already been working with them on a flu vaccine. So the guy at Pfizer is from Greece, and here's a couple of Turks. And lo and behold, those countries can work together. At a conference a couple of years ago, this husband and wife spoke. They said there's a possibility that we would have a pandemic and that we have the technology which might be able to be rapidly deployed, this new kind of RNA messenger vaccine that they were working on. And then in January and February, when they started to read about the virus in China, they said, wow, this might be the right application for it. They weren't to scale, so then they went to Pfizer, and that's how the whole thing came to be. They got the test results last Sunday night. They were so excited they had tea. These are people that are like committed to the science. On their wedding night, they went back to the laboratory. Those kind of people, the kind of people you're glad Earth has. I guess I say all of that to say, as I was reading it, I was thinking about the texts I was getting from listeners who were saying, oh, I know why we find out now. It's because the election is over and they held the results so as to compromise Trump's chances. What would have happened if we'd got this news in October? You read that and there's nothing to it at all. I mean, that sure doesn't seem to be on the minds of these people as they were awaiting the results.
One of the interesting things I saw about Pfizer's statement, and they invested, I think, somewhere north of $1 billion in their own money to develop this, is that they didn't take federal or international grant money from governments because of the red tape it would have imposed on their scientists.
Right.
And there's something deeply sad about that, because if you think they invested this $1 billion into that and got there first and got there without the red tape, how much, and this was sort of the case with, I believe with the FDA at the beginning, remember the tests, it took forever to get approval for new types of tests. And just, it's sad of me to think of all the billions of dollars of money that have been put into this that has seemingly been made inefficient because of, you know, the standards or red tape or bureaucracy that's been attached to some of these scientists, and they're not allowed to work.
Makes it sound like an impediment.
Success story.
Yeah, it makes it sound like an impediment, doesn't it, Austin? So what do we think about the travel restrictions, too? I mean, this is another instance where maybe the science is on their side, but they're doing a really bad job explaining it to us. If I go to where Eric is right now in Michigan, I have to quarantine myself for 2 weeks if I come back, or get a negative COVID test up to 72 hours before I get back in. Well, that's weird, because if I get a negative test 72 hours before I come back in, I have 3 days to, in fact, get infected or discover that, in fact, I am. But I'll be welcome back into Chicago.
Well, and the other thing that I don't understand, John, is if I have gotten exposed to it here, it can take up to 5 days for a test to show
absolutely
positive. So I could have been infected yesterday. I could get a test. I'm coming back on Sunday, so I can get a test tomorrow. And it seems rather meaningless. As one explanation of this, that's a meaningless requirement. So I don't know what to make of it exactly. I'm going to get tested just for the heck of it, though. It's so much fun to have something jammed up your nose.
That is exactly how Mulvaney had it. If they said, I mean, if they put up an iron curtain around Illinois, people would just, you know, they wouldn't pay attention to that either. I mean, how many restaurants are still serving food indoors? We have 100% prohibition on indoor dining in Illinois. There's buffets open. People are sending me pictures of buffets. Lisa, let's go to a Golden Corral. I can hook you up.
Yeah, no. The thing is, no. And at some point, I just want to tell the folks who run these places to just shut it all down. But I also feel a little bit like, look, if you're going to roll the dice like this as a consumer, then you're going to get what you're going to get. I don't have a ton of sympathy. I just don't.
It's but I do have sympathy, Lisa, for the people who might not get a hotel room. Hospital room, or who might be working in that hospital. People, the responders who are taking care of those people who get infected. So I mean, we're all in this together, and I think that's one thing that we really haven't all absorbed is the need for all of us to make sacrifices for this to go, you know, to minimize this.
I'm not arguing that point. I'm arguing the people who are doing this, despite all the warnings, and who are sort of saying, whatever, I don't know what I can do. And that isn't a line to say I don't care about hospital workers. I obviously do. I'm still acting as though, you know, unless I have something I really have to do, I'm staying home. When I want to exercise, I have a whole system through alleys that I walk, you know, so that I don't get sick. And God forbid, if I had gotten sick, I'm not going to give it to somebody else. I'm wearing a mask. Even we had a neighbor who needed to get something from our side of the fence. We're putting on masks. You know, we're making sure that we're taking care of each other. But there's not a lot I can do, and I don't know that the city can't be everywhere all the time. I understand what you're saying about these folks. You know, we don't want them. They'll end up in the hospitals, and they could get these hospitals workers sick. That's terrible. I just don't know what to do at the front end of that.
And I just wonder if the prospect of a vaccine is going to make people more careless, that they're going to think, well, I'll take my chances now because the vaccine's coming in the summer. I don't know how people are going to react to that. The feeling like there's probably a finish line in sight.
Yeah, there needs to be some education and reminders of we don't know the long-term effects of this. And that's what scares me too. Just hearing people talking to a few people who are long haulers, you know, and now suddenly have heart conditions that they don't know if this is sort of like, okay, is this the medication or is it, you know, is this a permanent thing?
Well, one of our listeners said yesterday that if you don't wear a mask or if you get it at a restaurant, you should be denied a hospital bed or medical care. And, I'm like, well, I get that, but yeah, we're not going to do that. And then I look down at my text line, 100% approval. Like, yeah, let's stick it to those people.
Well, you never know where someone got it either, for sure, right? So even if that were a moral stance to take, it'd be a dodgy proposition to say, well, we think you got it at the Golden Corral. So out to the
barbecue sauce on your shirt.
All right. Well, that's where we are today then in on the eve of Thanksgiving, on the eve of travel season, mingle with family season, eat food with one another season, 30 days, the city is supposed to be locked down. And if you travel to virtually any state, you're supposed to quarantine for 2 weeks. They don't want you to go there anyway. I don't know. There's a real sociological experiment going on before our very eyes, isn't there? And a governmental one, too, right, Austin? I mean, hopefully somebody someday is going to learn from this and figure out how to better govern people's behavior.
That's going to be really, really fascinating to see kind of our, 50 laboratories of democracy and what their forward-looking plans are for things like this, not to mention the federal government. But it's been crazy. I feel like the narrative on this changes every couple of weeks when we look at state to state. Like first, Southwest is like freaking out. And now it's like Florida looks like not utopia, but it looks a lot better than Illinois right now. And that too is changing all the time because there's so many factors that go into this. When there's nice weather, people maybe are not staying inside so much, and they're able to have less restrictions on things and do okay.
Is the Florida difference, do you think, a weather-related phenomenon, that they are doing better because people are still outside there a lot more than they are here?
Could be, but if you look at Illinois the past like 3 or 4 weeks, we've been not so bad. Like our weather's been, it's been the warmest November I think we've ever ever had, right?
Yeah, and that is an example of the sort of mixed scientific messaging we get. Eric said maybe Florida's better because they're able to go outside. It's getting worse in Illinois, so what do we do say? We say everybody go inside. And maybe we should say, no, everybody go outside. That is a conundrum for people. And the experts I've talked to really haven't put a fine point on the logic of that to me.
The dining thing, I think, is a great example of that, because if you think about the people who would risk going to do indoor dining right now, what do you think they're doing now that indoor dining at 20% capacity is not allowed?
Yeah.
They're having bigger and probably less safe gatherings inside, like their home. So there's like unintended, it's not as simple as just stopping that behavior with a state mandate.
Right. Well, but what you don't know, Austin, is that Brenda and I installed a $60,000 air filtration system in the ceiling of our house, so you can come over to our house safely. Oh, no, wait, we didn't do that, but the restaurants did. So where the Petersons are going to come over to our house now, it's exactly the point you're making, you know. But you know, so then I talked to these county health department officials, and they say, we just don't have the resources to restaurant by restaurant score them for their safety. In DuPage County, they were getting about 60 or 70 cases a day originally. Now they're getting 900 cases a day, and they have several thousand restaurants. So it's just the numbers are against them. There's no way to keep a score on who's safe and who is not. Speaking of Tony La Russa, the White Sox manager is the White Sox manager. He hasn't managed a game, but he's their guy. And now we find out earlier in the year he had a DUI. And the case, it almost sounds like the Sox didn't even know about that. The reporting is also that when he was pulled over, uh-oh, what does that say? Is that a white? Oh, no. What's the hat you just went and got, Austin? What does that say?
I just got my Sunday home Cardinals hat off the ground.
So do you have affection for Tony La Russa because he previously managed your team?
I have enormous affection for Tony La Russa, but I always knew him as sort of like the taciturn guy who is a great winner and like loved animals, and not that he was kind of like a drunk asshole who apparently is like, you know, going up to people and saying, hey, I'm a Hall of Famer, and like showing his ring and stuff.
Hey, brother, right? I'm a Hall of Famer guy. There were issues against the hire, like age, or can he still be effective in 2020? Then he's got this DUI on his record. And what's really troubling to people is that he sort of did the old do you know who I am guy thing, which is the worst of celebrity behavior. But the White Sox still sound like they're behind him. Eric, would you, at this juncture, get rid of him before he even steps onto the field?
Well, I wouldn't have hired him in the first place, but I think that, I don't think so. I don't think that, didn't Ditka have some DUIs in his record? I mean, this
he was
not
singing
uncommon.
While drunk. I know he's saying, take me out to the ball game completely intoxicated. I don't remember if he was driving while drunk.
I mean, I'm pretty militant about drunk driving. I think it's a really terrible thing to do. I mean, it is a really grotesque offense. On the other hand, I don't know that you rescind somebody's job because they got caught DUI. Yep. So my answer is no, but not an emphatic no, just no.
All of it just feels old school, doesn't it? I mean, this is like, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago when people got pulled over for drunk driving. There's no excuse for it now with rideshare. And yeah, pulling the whole, do you know who I am?
You should get fired for that.
I'm sorry. These are a lot of young people playing baseball. That's not a good leader to have in place. Yeah, I don't know about rescinding it because of, you know, maybe one offense, but it really calls the character into question. I don't know that he should be leading the team.
I don't know if it matters that the offense occurred before he knew he was going to be leading young men again. You shouldn't be doing it anyway, but Cardinal Hat Boy, what do you say?
You got to keep him. Let it ride. He made a horrible mistake, but, you know, people make horrible mistakes all the time. And there's some room for redemption in that case, and I don't know if firing him would really do anything besides punish this person. Now, whether he's a successful manager in and of himself, you know, that is a whole separate question that I'm curious to see. But I'm going to be a Sox fan all year because of
Rivers. Are you really? I mean, this is going to bring you into the fold?
That's why. Yeah. Wow. One anyway. I am.
I got people getting
I'm
off the bus.
One. They're my American League team for sure.
I've become a Sox fan because of the Ricketts family. So, I think he could very well end up being successful because I think the Sox have a really good young team.
Oh, I could manage this team. Come on.
You probably could. And so he may end up, you know, sort of stumbling into success. They've been building that team for a couple of years. I don't think they should have let Renteria go necessarily, but I mean, it was, they did flame out in the playoffs, but it was a very unusual season.
He had a terrible playoff, but Renteria, wasn't he the runner-up for manager of the year? He could have been the manager of the year and got fired from that team that year. And then they bring in Tony La Russa. I'm more like you, Eric. I didn't like the hire to begin with, but as a rule, I don't think a drunk driving offense should take away your income. Not that Tony La Russa needs it, but I don't think that because you did something wrong, we should make part of the punishment that you don't have employment. So I don't like punishing him that way for that.
I agree with that, man.
Especially if it's not related to your, like, Jeffrey Toobin did what he did on a work call. Like, you're kind of, your hands are tied there. Not, no pun intended, on hands tied. But
if only his hands had been tied.
So that's different than, you know, something outside of work, bad behavior. I think it's much different.
But, you know, it is one of those weird jobs where your personal behavior as a public figure, even though you ought to be able to, quote unquote, manage a team, your persona or your as a public figure, that's part of your job, too. Put it this way, and I'm glad that you said that you're now going to be a White Sox fan, because at the end of the day, you're trying to sell tickets. I heard today from some Sox fans who now don't like the Sox and they don't want to have anything to do with them. They'll probably still watch, right? But this is not a good way to sell your product if you've got a guy that the very fan base doesn't like.
And I've got a hypothetical for you. What if he's caught again drunk driving? Under these circumstances, I mean, you pointed out, John, that this all happened before he was hired. But now that he's been hired, now that he's kind of on notice, Would a third offense? I mean, I would argue maybe that a third offense would be okay. That's it, Tony.
Yeah. Thanks. Well, that's either alcoholism or belligerence then. And either way, he probably shouldn't be working then, not in that capacity. Let's talk about the president's unwillingness to cede power. Although in the last 12 hours, the reporting is that the inner circle is coming to terms with it, that mm-hmm. the president's messaging is going to change to who do I blame rather than do I leave. Are you reading it that way, Lisa?
The story that I read in, I believe it was the Wall Street Journal, and that I saw on MSNBC, they were saying that he will not use any form of the word concede, but that he will go. There won't be any kind of congratulatory, you know, I lost, you won, good fight kind of deal. That he's going to walk away. He now realizes that some of these lawsuits that have been filed, they're futile. Or he's coming around to it. I'm sorry, I should say that.
I've become vastly entertained by his stubbornness and his refusal to concede and the flailing around that he's doing, where he's like firing people who are not supporting him, who are looking for other jobs and so on. I think that history is going to judge this as one of the funniest little windows of time in American history. That this buffoon.
Funny like how? Like a clown?
Like he got clobbered in this election by 5 million votes, by more than 5 million votes, and I think it's going to be end up around 80 electoral college votes, about 78 electoral college votes he's going to lose by, and so the fact that he's fighting this way and all the craziness surrounding this, I was frightened by it at first, and then I became just amused by it. Like this is actually kind of funny. This guy who every day is waking up stewing and seething about, he just lost. You know, he lost a political race. It happens to thousands of people every year in this country. They lose a race and they go and they lick their wounds and they move on. Sometimes they come back. But this guy is acting like somebody said he's acting like a child in the Pop-Tarts aisle at a grocery store.
I don't think I was fearful because I've been really trying to keep track of all of the lawsuits and trying to read each, you know, what's going on in the court cases. And everybody seems a bit, every court case you read about, the judge seems to be befuddled. Even the attorneys who are filing the lawsuits seem to be like, well, we really didn't find anything wrong here. And so it sort of seemed like this exercise that was necessary for that side, an exercise to engage in, but that at the end of the day, there's no there there.
You weren't depressed or terrified, Austin, when you heard about his unwillingness to leave and that either it was going to work or we'd have some sort of crisis?
Yeah, I think the coup talk was really, I don't want to say it was completely manufactured because, like, we know who we're dealing with here. But I think it was irresponsible a little bit on the part of some people to gin up that kind of fear. Like, we're not going to have a peaceful transfer of power. We knew Trump was going to say wild stuff, regardless of what the election result was. But there's no real evidence of like a total, besides like some offhand remark, which are bad, like what Pompeo said of like, yeah, there will be a peaceful transition of power, like to Trump's second term. then he spent 2 minutes like walking that back and saying, yeah, it'll be totally fine. Don't worry about it. But it was just kind of like a trollish remark. I don't think that's something people should be worried about. I agree with Lisa that almost every court case that I've seen is very thin also. And even if you had a couple that were good, you would need them in like three or four states to overturn hundreds of thousands of votes.
Well, that's
point.
What it is. And what kind of
really strict?
And what kind of case would you be talking about
on this too? Sort of like, oh, there was like a big freak out over Mitch McConnell saying, oh, you know, he has a right to file, you know, a lawsuit and challenge the count if he wants. I mean,
he does.
He does have that right. I mean, exactly. And so he doesn't carry the weight of God here. That's what he does have the right to do that. Mitch McConnell, who I'm saying he doesn't have the weight of God here to say, oh, this is going to happen. You know, he's going to change the outcome or somehow flip it. He's just saying he has the right to do it. And that is what the folks on that side are saying. So, and sort of, to sort of I think, kind of curry favor and stay in his good graces. Again, the guy, Trump won nearly 70 million votes. That's
more than that, I think.
Yeah.
And so for people who are living in red states, who are elected leaders, they have kind of this careful tightrope to walk, in my opinion. And so they're going to sort of, you know, say what they need to do to keep the peace.
Well, I wish I had your optimism or positivity. I have not had that all along, and I'm getting more and more that way. But the three of you sure think it's a slam dunk. Why wouldn't it be? Am I misrepresenting?
I don't know if I think it's a slam dunk. I think there's just a road to follow, and then maybe we all are sort of getting sort of. I don't think you, John, you're a smart guy. I just think a lot of people the understanding of this process is not widespread, and so, you know, on both sides, like for Trump to say he can't declare that he's the winner. Usually we have a winner declared on election night, and they're out on the stage, and you know the confetti's flying. So that's not true. But it's also true that we vote for electors, and they will come together in December and seal the deal. And that's really when we'll know.
But all of that talk makes me nervous. Like they say, well, but what can you have rogue electors? Yeah. And do they have to follow the mandate? And I'm like, worried about that and whose allegiances are where. And I worry, too, not that an individual voted wrong or was corrupt. I was worried that a court would rule, say, in Pennsylvania, that's tens of thousands, or in Wisconsin, tens of thousands of ballots needed to be pulled back because of a timestamp thing or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And I worry that if you just throw enough against the wall in 2020, maybe one of them does stick. I was thoroughly expecting some crazy-ass judge we never heard of to go, yeah, that's unconstitutional how they let the ballots get counted after midnight. And so Pennsylvania and Wisconsin flip, and I'm like, holy cow. And my nightmare has been 269-269, because then it goes Republican. So I'll tell you what, not until that hand's on the Bible, and the Bible's put away in January, do I think and the Mayflower van is there. And you know that Mike Pompeo thing, you know, Eric, you were saying you think this is all funny, like you're enjoying this. I thought the Pompeo thing was yet another low. That little, he didn't laugh when he said that.
There will be a smooth transition to a second Trump administration. All right, we're ready. The world is watching what's taking place here. We're going to count all the votes.
And then he talked for another minute or two without saying we are prepared for or are preparing for a peaceful transition. What an ass. It wasn't the Secretary of the State. It was a partisan hack.
Yeah, well, there's some talk that he is trying to preserve his political viability because he may want to run for president in 2024.
How does that do that, though? I mean, I guess I just answered the question, right?
30 million votes.
Yeah.
That's how.
Yeah.
Well, I believe that if Trump decides tomorrow that he's going to run for president in 2024, he says, you know, I can't steal this election back, so I'm going to run in 2024. He's got to be the presumptive front runner. I mean, there's just
turn off his microphone. Somebody unzoom Eric. He has got to be the presumptive runner for 2024. Do you have any idea how horrible that sounds? Can I have a honeymoon here, like for 10 minutes? Even. Yeah, well, I guess that wraps up this week's edition of The Mincing Rascals.
Really good to see you.
Yeah. any last thoughts from any of you? Lisa, you're going to just go back to doing what you're doing there?
Today? I'm writing about this whole the U lines contracting COVID-19. And them being at the White House, that they are potentially part of a second super spreader event. I'm hoping it's okay to say here, the AP is just reporting that Lauren Underwood has beat Jim Oberweis, that they've called the race. So she will get a second term in office in that west and northwest suburban and exurban district that she'd flipped 2 years ago.
I just wanted to hope that John can drop in here a little bit of this interview with Oberweis when Oberweis thought he won.
I know he was a jerk and I was a jerk to him. I was telling him how to. That's the kind of talking point that on the campaign trail works. But once you become a member of that body, then I think you need to talk like and vote like. Listen to me. I'm giving you advice, Mr. Oberweis. Don't use that kind of language because it's just not true. I think people
have you listened to AOC? Wait a minute. Just to stop. Have you listened to AOC? She said those kinds of things.
But I believe the same thing happened with Underwood that happened with Biden, which is that the same day vote favored
votes,
the Republican.
Yeah.
But it was mail-in votes and later votes that favored the Democrat.
Mm.
And we can dust off the milk dud nickname from Oberweis. He gave up a Senate seat that he probably could have won again, a seat that then was won by a Democrat.
Yeah.
And he mounted his, I believe, his third or fourth, maybe third run for U.S. Congress. That he lost. He's also run for Senate and governor, and I don't know what else.
But. Yeah, pick it.
I'm sorry, it isn't in that first take of the AP story, but what we have, and it hasn't been called, she was up by nearly 5,000 votes.
Wow.
And still sort of the percentage, sort of that 200,000 and change for Underwood and 195,000, almost 196,000 for Oberweis. That put them sort of about a percentage point apart. So it's not a terrible showing by Oberweis, but certainly he didn't win. Yeah,
it's interesting strategies, right? Like the Republicans, at least the top of the ticket, Trump said, "Go vote on Election Day. Go vote on Election Day," mm-hmm. and the Democrats won the White House. Think about that. During a pandemic, what's a better chance of getting the most votes? Give people a month to vote by mail or hope that they all show up on Election Day during a pandemic? If you didn't know anything else, you'd say, I think the team that's going to vote for a month by mail and other ways has a better chance of gathering the most votes. I mean, just as a strategy.
I thought her closing argument, and you guys can tell me if I'm wrong here, but I thought her closing argument, her closing ad was really effective because she positioned herself as working with Trump. She got some kind of diabetes drug, some kind of bill passed, and she said, "And President Trump signed it." There was no sort of like I'm a Democrat and he's a Republican and I don't like him. There was none of that. It was sort of her walking down the street. I think it was downtown Naperville. And just sort of like all these people are milling about and, you know, and it was very positive.
Hmm.
And she made herself look like, hey, I can reach across the aisle. I can even work with that guy.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a really, I don't know, if you were on the fence, you'd probably go with her. You know, I just thought it was a really effective ad.
The day of voting strategy also is risky in November. In good part of the country, you can get snowstorms, terrible weather, and can depress turnout. So if you're counting on getting your voters out on Election Day, you are running a risk.
Yeah,
really bad strategy. I agree to cast out on in-person voting, which Trump then backed away from. And he would tweet about states like Florida and be like, go early vote, because it was a terrible strategy. And even with that, like Republicans made all these gains in the House and in a lot of state legislatures, these trifecta Republican legislatures now in places like Montana that hadn't had a Republican governor in 20 years, New Hampshire, House flipped Republican. Speaking of Green New Deal, though, did you guys see Heather got retweeted by AOC? Like
yes,
huge tweet.
I did not. What was the tweet that AOC retweeted?
It was about Rahm potentially being an appointee to transportation and someone's reaction to that. I can't, maybe Lisa, you remember, but it was, she was reporting on someone's reaction to Rahm being appointed.
She reported, she took a snapshot of AOC's comment that Rahm would be a divisive pick in a Biden-Harris administration. And it was a real signal. I agreed with Heather's take on that. She's like, ooh, AOC really sort of throwing down the gauntlet here. I'm not quoting directly, but it really was a signal. And man, it went viral.
Wow.
You know, and AOC even was like, yeah, he should not be in that administration. And she said, because he's not good, you know, kind of pointed to the Laquan McDonald case, saying that he did not handle that well. That's the delay, you know, as we all know, the delay in publicly releasing that shooting video seemed to be tied to his second election bid that it was released after that. And so,
Right.
A lot of concerns about that.
So Heather's too. So Heather's too big for us now.
No, I just made a note. It was nice to know her because she can't come back to this puny little podcast ever again. By the way, some of my listeners were telling me who they thought the replacement should be for Alex Trebek on Jeopardy, and
it's gonna be you.
You would be great at it.
It would be great,
John. That's a good idea.
Oh God, no, no. Oh heavens, no, no. You know. No. And the thing that terrifies me the most is just like the little shit I always get wrong, which, Alex, you can't do that on Jeopardy. So it would be terrible. You know who would be good is Neil deGrasse Tyson. Are you Neil deGrasse Tyson fans? I think he would be really good. George Steph.
Me Too thing?
No, maybe really?
He had a controversy.
Really? Oh, I'm sorry.
I was thinking Steve Harvey would be great.
Good. Good. George Stephanopoulos is one people are pointing to. He'd have to want the job. You don't have to work real hard for it. But
does seem like a pretty easy gig, doesn't it?
If you bet $100 on Trump and he is number 30 on one of the wagering lists, Donald Trump, to get back on TV as the host of Jeopardy, if you bet $100 and it wins, you get $100,000. So maybe if you got $100 to burn, maybe that's a good bet.
That seems like a Saturday Night Live sketch, doesn't it?
Yeah, Eric Zorn would be a good one on this.
Sad. Loser. Hey, I got a question for the panel. This came up in one of our meetings today. Should we refer to it as Zoomsgiving or Thanks Zooming?
Ooh, I like Zoomsgiving.
I like the first one. Austin doesn't like either.
If you had to choose.
He's having garage giving, didn't you hear?
That's a good idea.
Thanks, garaging.
Better, I think.
Yeah. What team were you on, Eric?
I was on Thanks Zooming.
Okay. Well, there you are. Take that back to the Tribune. Thank you, Eric Zorn. Thank you, Lisa Donovan. Thank you, Austin Berg. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Elif Garris. Thanks for joining us today. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.